This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. The start of Vermont's next legislative session in January is still months away, but one big policy debate is already heating up. Pun intended, sorry. It's over the clean heat standard. The goal of this still largely hypothetical program is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that come from heating buildings. Proponents point to scientific consensus, which says we need to reduce our fossil fuel dependency for the sake of keeping the planet habitable. And they note that Vermont has committed by law to reduce its emissions dramatically. Opponents, including Governor Phil Scott, allege the clean heat standard would be too expensive for Vermonters to handle. A new report from state utility regulators raises questions about whether the policy is right for a small state like Vermont to take on alone. Later in the show, we'll talk through the report with a representative from the Public Utility Commission. But first, we are joined by reporter Carrie Klein, who recently covered Vermont's clean heat law for Canary Media. It's a nonprofit news outlet that's focused on clean energy. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. And listeners, you can join this conversation as well. Do you have questions about how the clean heat standard might work? Give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Carrie, people in Vermont have been hearing about a version of the clean heat standard for years now. It's been written and rewritten and passed by the legislature and vetoed by the governor, and that veto has been overridden. What are the basics of the clean heat standard? What exactly would it do?
Yeah, definitely. So the clean heat standard is basically a method that would incentivize suppliers of fuel oil, natural gas, and other heating fuels to reduce their emissions by implementing things that qualify as clean heat measures. So those include heat pumps, weatherizing homes, using electric appliances for heating, and also some potentially more controversial options like biofuels and hydrogen for heating.
What's controversial about those options?
So climate advocates argue that those options still contribute greenhouse gas emissions. And to really have a clean heat transition, they'd like a focus more on completely electrifying homes. Heat pumps can go a long way to reducing emissions, especially in Vermont, which is headed towards having a grid completely powered by renewables by 2035.
So talk us through exactly how this marketplace for clean heat credits might work. I mean, fuel companies can buy them or generate them. Is that right?
Yeah, it's still not completely clear, even in these new draft rules that have been released. But essentially, fuel companies will take measures to weatherize homes, implement heat pumps, and they would get a credit based on how much carbon they are reducing by choosing to do cleaner options instead of continuing to supply fossil fuels.
So one of the reasons that Vermont has been thinking about implementing a clean heat standard for years now is that the state has to hit certain climate goals that are outlined in a law known here as the Global Warming Solutions Act. Can you remind us what that is?
Definitely. So the Global Warming Solutions Act commits Vermont to reducing its emissions 26% below 2005 levels by this year, 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, and 80% below those levels by 2050. And heating homes makes up a good chunk of those emissions. It accounts for 18%. And right now in Vermont, over half of homes are heated with fuel oil and propane, which release a lot of methane and CO2 when burned. So there's a lot of potential there when you're electrifying homes to significantly cut emissions.
Okay, so earlier this month, the Public Utility Commission released these draft rules and a report about how exactly this clean heat standard might work. And you wrote this story for Canary Media. After looking at this report, what stood out to you about the findings?
Yeah, so I think many people who have been watching this process were hoping they would find out a bit more from this report. There's still a lot that's left to be figured out, but it is only a draft of what the clean heat standard could be. The final rules will be presented on January 15th, which should have more information on what this could cost, how it will actually work, and what it would look like. The draft rules for now do include what qualifies as a clean heat measure, which are some of the things I mentioned before, like heat pumps, weatherization, geothermal systems. They also say that one clean heat credit is equivalent to 1 ton of carbon dioxide. But the way you define how much carbon certain heating methods use can be a bit complex. So it's still not clear how much each measure would account for in terms of credits. And also, interestingly, the PUC, the Public Utility Commission, put out a companion report saying they're considering other options besides the clean heat standard. Creating a market is a really complex thing to do. Vermont is a very small state. So one potential option they're considering would be a charge on the sale of fuel oil, propane, and kerosene. And those funds raised, they say, would be spent on projects such as weatherization and electrification that reduce the use of fossil fuels.
So that's a fee instead of a more market-based solution.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And in a bit, we're going to be joined by the General Counsel for the Public Utility Commission. We will speak more with her about the report that they've put out and their ideas for what could come in place of a clean heat standard. And if you have questions about any of this, we know it's a bit complicated, but there's a lot of Vermonters out there who have been studying the possibility of a clean heat standard for a long time now. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 800-639-2211 is our number. You can also email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So Carrie, one thing I just want to make sure we like reiterate a couple times during this program is that there are still so many question marks about the clean heat standard and what it could cost individual Vermonters. But that's also seems like it's the big concern that we've heard from folks when we've done shows about this in the past. There are just a lot of question marks about cost, right?
Definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of questions about cost. Right now, it's not clear what the exact price would be in terms of how it would affect people's energy bills. But there was another study that the PUC did to look at what this could cost over the coming years. And they found there would be around $9 billion in societal costs, but $12 billion in societal benefits over the next 25 years. So the study says that the benefits exceed those costs by around $3 billion. And some of those benefits are the avoided costs of damages from extreme weather events, health effects of pollution. So looking at it in the long term, in the big picture, there's some upfront costs that would be outweighed by benefits in the long run. But in terms of specific costs, it's still, you know, going to become clearer over the next few months what those could be.
Right. So right now, there's no way to say that you as a Vermonter will see X increase on your bills this winter, or not this winter, certainly, because there is no clean heat standard yet, but in a couple of years, if it were to be implemented.
Yes.
So one big player in all these conversations has been fuel suppliers, both small and large. What did you learn about how fuel suppliers are feeling about the clean heat standard?
Yeah, so fuel suppliers are concerned that they won't be able to keep up if they're required to buy alternate fuels, like biofuels, which can be more expensive for them. So there's concerns that they may not do as well in their businesses. And that definitely is a valid concern. On the other hand, some of the climate advocates I've spoken to point out the opportunities for job creation from moving more into electric heating and installing heat pumps, weatherizing homes. All of those could provide opportunities as well.
And Carrie, one thing I've been curious to ask you, since your reporting covers lots of other places, not just Vermont, have you heard of any similar efforts going on in other parts of the country to create some sort of market-based solution to reducing fossil fuel usage in the thermal sector?
Yeah, so a handful of other states are looking at similar designs. Maryland and Massachusetts are in the process of designing somewhat similar clean heat standards. Colorado has directed its largest gas utilities to create their own clean heat plants to reduce their emissions and transition to cleaner options. But really, this is a very new thing and something that I think a lot of states will be following and looking at Vermont as a potential model to learn from the challenges that Vermont has faced and what Vermont ends up choosing to do. A lot of states are figuring out how they're actually going to accomplish their emission reduction goals over the coming years. And heating homes is a really big source of those. So clean heat standards are something I think we're going to see more of.
Mm. So do you think that larger states, I don't know, like a Colorado or a California, can learn something from a very small state like Vermont?
Yeah, I mean, every state is different. For example, most of Vermont fuel is from really small suppliers. There's only a small amount of natural gas, and other states have really different systems. So each plan really does have to be designed to the specific state. But I think watching Vermont and seeing how they're moving this forward in the legislature, the different steps of the process are something that other states could definitely learn from.
Mm. And remind us, Carrie, what is coming up next for the clean heat standard? We're still in this process of report writing and research. Are there any deadlines or big moments in time coming up that folks should be aware of?
Yeah, definitely. So the Public Utility Commission has just released their draft rules, and they will have to submit final rules for what the clean heat standard would look like on January 15th. After that, the legislature will take a look at those and basically decide the path forward from there. They're not obligated even to vote on the standard. They could choose to, they may not. They might decide more analysis and more research is needed. They may also decide to go in a different direction and consider something else. And for Vermonters who are interested in giving their input, there will be a public hearing that the Public Utility Commission is holding on October 30th at 6:30 p.m., where people can join online.
Carrie Klein is with the nonprofit news organization Canary Media. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Today, we are focused on Vermont's efforts to cut emissions from the thermal sector, that is, heating homes and buildings with fuel. Vermont lawmakers passed the Affordable Heat Act last year, and the state is now in the process of establishing a clean heat standard. It's designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the thermal sector by establishing requirements for companies that import fossil heat fuels, into Vermont. Before we get to our next guest, I want to take a couple of calls. Let's start with Bruce in Essex. Bruce, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, hi there. Thank you for tackling such a complex question. I was the state planning director for the late Governor Snelling back in 91, and one of the things he said to us continually, the single most threatening comment he ever heard was, Vermont can show the nation, or Vermont can be number one, because I think, as the PUC just pointed out, Vermont has limited capabilities and a limited population, and we are dealing with an extremely complicated revolution in how we heat homes and various other things. So this may be a bridge too far for a small state like Vermont. And I don't want to take much time, but I listened to the Clean Heat Standard hearings and the hearings on the Renewable Energy Standard. And the consultants they brought in for the Renewable Energy Standard said, basically, there's nothing Vermont can do that makes a difference for itself in terms of avoiding future harm, or the world. It's going to be China and India, big generators of greenhouse gases, and other nations as well. So I think we have to get back into our own shoes here in Vermont, recognize our limitations, and do what it's possible to do, and not develop something so complex we can't even predict the consequences.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for that context, the work that you've done, and your opinion. Really appreciate it. We also want to collect more opinions on the Clean Heat Standard from you and questions as well. 800-639-2211 is our number. Let's take one more caller before we get to our next guest. John in Stratford is on the air. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to follow up with that not only is it complex, but it puts the burden on those Vermonters least able to afford it. You know, the fact is, a few years ago, I was trying to decide between a heat pump and a propane heater as a backup to our wood heat. And the fact that being a low-income Vermonter, I couldn't get the tax breaks, which has served as incentives for many people to get heat pumps, but doesn't really work for those of us who don't make enough to pay federal income tax and take tax breaks. So it really is not only, as the previous caller said, trying to solve a national and international problem with a Vermont solution, which is, in terms of the environment, totally impractical, but it really puts the burden on those least able to afford it.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that call. And let's bring in our guest now to discuss some of these concerns that we are hearing already. The Public Utility Commission has been tasked with figuring out exactly how to and if we should implement a clean heat standard. It's a three-person commission appointed by Governor Phil Scott. We're joined today by June Tierney. She is the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Public Service. June, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Michaela. It's a pleasure to be here.
June, could you tell us a little bit about what exactly your role is in all of this? Help us understand, because it sure is a complicated process.
It is. And just to clarify a little bit here, the Public Utility Commission and the Public Service Department are two separate agencies, but our missions are very intertwined. We have different responsibilities in the space of energy and telecommunications and other public utilities. So what the department does is it advocates for the public, for people like John who just spoke. It also does the planning for our energy supply, and it also has a role in just about every case that appears before the PUC, whether it's about siting energy infrastructure or rates that a utility proposes to charge for service, or complaints, and everything in between. If you can think it about energy or telecommunications, the department has a role in it. Specifically for the Clean Heat Standard, our role has been somewhat, not nearly as prolific as the Public Utility Commission's. What the legislature chose to do with Act 18, the Clean Heat Standard legislation, was to charge the Public Utility Commission with preparing a draft rule that would lay out a framework for implementing a clean heat standard in Vermont. And one of the responsibilities that the legislature gave the department was to conduct what's called a potentiality study to see whether and how one might go about implementing the measures that are needed for a clean heat standard, and then in turn to help the utility with that potentiality study to perform its other responsibility under Act 18, which is to estimate the impacts of the clean heat standard on customers, including impacts to customer rates and fuel bills for participating and not participating customers, the net impacts on total spending on energy for thermal sector end uses, fossil fuel reductions, greenhouse gas emission reductions, and if possible, impacts on economic activity and employment. That's a mouthful, And what the Public Utility Commission is expected, that is to say, what folks generally think will happen, is that they will engage in modeling, which is what most of us do in order to come up with the numbers that we use in the regulatory world to assess things like cost. That the PUC will do a model, and it'll have a variety of inputs of data and the like. And one of those inputs would be that potentiality study from the Department of Public Service. Now, Michaela, are you sorry yet that you asked me that question?
Just a little bit. Okay. But you've confirmed that this is a really complicated issue, not just in what exactly the Clean Heat Standard might do, but who is in charge of figuring out how it could work. We already have a number of callers calling in with their thoughts on it, too. So let's take a couple of those, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them, June. We'll start with Jeff in Richmond. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call. My question is that we have been trying various different things, including what I understand the PUC is proposing as a system benefit charge for fossil fuels for well over a decade. And we're no further along, and the climate crisis has gotten considerably worse. Why not work with the Clean Heat Standard that is being proposed to make it work, with the understanding, I think it's safe to assume that the people who sell fossil fuels are not going to like whatever we come up with, and so work into the standard how to address low and moderate income and how to make progress on this very, very urgent issue.
Mm. Thank you, Jeff. So I think what Jeff is referring to here is in part the fact that the Public Utility Commission released this draft rule and a report earlier this month that in part showed that it might not be a smart idea to implement a clean heat standard at all. Jeff's saying, no, this is really urgent. We need to figure out something to make it work. Not everyone's going to be happy. June, what are your thoughts?
Well, I can certainly agree that not everybody is going to be happy, and I can also agree that this is a very urgent matter, but I strenuously disagree with the proposition that we should simply implement something because we got to do something. I think it's enormously important to be thoughtful about what we're going to do, and I think that the Public Utility Commission and the stakeholders who've participated in that process to come up with this draft rule have been the definition of thoughtful. I would go so far as to say that the legislature has put a great deal of thought into this too. It's just that the process by which the legislature came to Act 18, in my opinion, was flawed. And so a lot of the thoughtfulness got lost in the end product. And so what we wound up with is a situation where a lot of specificity was put into law about what we're supposed to do with the clean heat standard. And then the PUC was told to go out and make it so, because we have this other law called the Global Warming Solutions Act that's putting us under the gun in order to achieve certain reductions by a certain period of time. When you mix all those dynamics together, what you get is the very best effort that we're able to put forward, but not just within state government, but with external stakeholders as well. And you have a clean heat standard that an authoritative entity is telling you is likely not workable for this state. They're offering an alternative solution that will in and of itself occasion considerable debate and people will not be happy, but it does have the virtue of not being complex. But I do not think that embarking wholesale on this because of the emergency that we're trying to deal with is the answer. I think a better answer is to say, what can we realistically do? What can we realistically afford? And what is it we're trying to achieve? The goals so far are to get carbon reductions down. Fair enough. We also have to think about things like resiliency. You know, these storms are not going to stop happening. And so we have to ensure that our folks are able to deal with the storms, they're able to recover from the storms, and it could well be that our resources need to be directed in the first instance to those things.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for calling in. Let's go next to Betty in Rutland. Betty, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. This is wonderful to have this brought out. In the 70s, we had an apartment house that we also lived in upstairs, and we made it the back apartment really insulated extremely well. We had storm windows and everything, and put electric heat in there because it was a three-room apartment. It cost at least 2.5 times to heat that what it had cost before, because we had an oil furnace. And the one of the other biggest problems is there is not enough electricity to heat everybody's homes, to use heat pumps for electric cars. There just isn't, it isn't being generated enough. So the thoughtfulness, yes, the man is very, very right from the Public Utilities Commission. This has not been well thought out. It has not been programmed. It's the same thing when they brought all these electric vehicles on and then there's so many problems. And God knows that they're the things that you plug in to generate electricity for your vehicle are run by diesel for the most part.
Mm. Well, thank you, Betty, for calling in. I just want to jump in to clarify. Our guest right now is June Tierney. She's the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Public Service. And prior to her appointment, she was the general counsel to the Vermont Public Utility Commission. June, what are your thoughts there for Betty and for other folks who have noticed major differences in the cost of heating their apartment or their home over the decades?
Well, there are a couple things there. For one, I'm relieved to hear that insulating and putting in storm windows and converting to electric heat turned out to be something beneficial for Betty, even though the cost was considerable, because I'm going to guess that those measures are serving her very well now, as opposed to being on an oil furnace. And to the point, it's interesting that Betty undertook those measures without there being a clean heat standard. You know, she did that because she deemed that to be in her best interest at the time when she took the measures. And I think that that's, you know, that is a very promising path that we are already embarked upon and that can be further encouraged by thoughtful state programming. And the net result for a society, I think, at the end is always better when you have used a carrot approach as opposed to a stick approach. Now, as for the business about there not being enough electricity, I would caution on that point that, you know, details such as enough electricity, how much electricity, when is it generated, what is it generated by, et cetera, those are all important details to fill in when you're making a statement like we do or do not have enough electricity to power electric vehicles and to heat homes. I think it is fair to say as a matter of planning that our grid capacity and the like grows and evolves in order to handle our electric load, so that if there is, in fact, a decided uptick in electric vehicle ownership, for instance, you can have some confidence that there will be a grid that can handle that additional load as well. But at the end of the day, you know, it depends on our best projections to know when and where we're going to, you know, land this thing in the way that is most societally beneficial. Just a few years ago, folks were saying we really, really, really need to up our capacity on the grid because electric vehicles are going to be in every driveway before the end of the decade. And then not too long ago, we had the folks at ISO New England telling us, well, you know, the pace of adoption for electric vehicles hasn't exactly been what we projected. And so maybe not so much just right now do we need to be concerned about that. All I'm getting at is these things are very changeable. And so I would caution against folks who dismiss or reject a policy such as the Clean Heat Standard because they've made an assessment based on today that there isn't enough electricity today to support it. It's better to think that if this becomes mandated, adequate planning will have to follow as well in order to make sure that the standard that's being required can be met. That is at the core of the debate, though, right now, is it can it in fact be met? And my department has put out a report that says, yeah, it's technologically feasible, but you really got to look at the costs here. And I heard a comment not too long ago, I think, Michaela, it might have been you who was describing this as the report that signaled that there's a $9 billion cost, but an ultimate $12 billion benefit. So the net is a $3 billion societal benefit. That sounds good until you start looking at that. And you realize that what you're talking about is an abstraction. It's $3 billion of benefit at a future point in time. And yes, it's societal in nature, but that's very cold comfort to somebody like Betty or Jeff or John, who have to deal with the realities of the economic impact of this policy on their wallets today.
Hmm. Well, we're getting lots of calls here. Jared in Montpelier is next. Jared, you're on the air. What's your question or your comment?
Hi, Michaela. Good afternoon. Nice to be with you and Commissioner Tierney. Thanks for doing the show. I just want to make sure that when we're talking about the costs and benefits, that we're doing so in a full and accurate way. And I just heard the conversation about, you know, the projected societal benefits.
Right.
And I also want to pause on this question of heating costs and heating savings, because there's a second half of the equation that's getting missed, and that is...
Jared, do you mind if I jump in here just to give folks a little more context before you keep going? Jared, who's calling in, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is Jared Duvall, a member of the Vermont Climate Council and a co-author of Vermont's Climate Action Plan?
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Yes, and I'm calling in because any potential price increase that would happen on the fossil side would only happen, A, if fossil fuel corporations decide to pass that cost of compliance onto their consumers, and B, it would be related to offsetting what they then need to pay to decrease the price of cleaner heating options. So whenever we talk about any potential upward price pressure on things like propane and fuel oil, I think it's important to recognize what that would then go to: higher incentives and lower costs for weatherization, for heat pumps, for cleaner heating options, which by the design of the Affordable Heat Act are required to be disproportionately and progressively provided to Vermonters with lower and middle incomes. So I just wanted to add that because I think it's really important that we don't just look at the cost side of the equation, that we look at the benefits, including the cost savings of moving away from really high cost, price volatile heating fuels that has been far too expensive for Vermonters for generations, and that certainly I, as an individual climate counselor, my motivation in supporting a market-based program like the Clean Heat Standard is to help Vermonters move away from that exposure and dependence to really high-cost fossil heating fuels and be able to lower heating bills through more efficient and cleaner options that give us a win-win of both lower heating bills and of reducing pollution.
Well, Jared, thank you so much for calling in. And I just want to reiterate here, too, that we do not at this time know the exact cost differential and what your heating bill could look like if and when the Clean Heat Standard is implemented. There's still a lot of question marks about what this could look like. We got an email just now from Spence who writes, if everyone took the attitude that what we do in Vermont makes no difference to climate change, then the world would never make progress on reducing carbon emissions. The fact is, Vermont punches above its weight on many issues, and other states often look to us for leadership on complex issues, such as with the Affordable Heating Act. Let's take another call here. We have Brian in Moortown on the line. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the great discussion. I think it's super important that we continue to explore ways to clean up our heating act, so to speak, and our energy act. But what I often find frustrating is the real lack of focus on reducing our energy demand generally in our lifestyles and our daily choices, reducing how much we're consuming. We should be focused on building smaller houses, driving less, using a lot less energy by buying less, buying fewer new items and so on in our lives, and reusing more. I think that ultimately is going to make the biggest difference on future generations ahead of us that we're raising, and also the broader landscape globally. So thanks.
Thank you, Brian. And Commissioner Tierney, I'm curious if that perspective has come up at all in the work that you're doing around the Clean Heat Standard, which, as Brian says, is focused on changing the type of fuel that we're using, but not necessarily focused on reducing overall energy usage.
Well, first off, I think it's a terrific comment. And from Brian's lips to God's ears on the point, it's something that, in my opinion, has been woefully neglected in the larger conversation. I, too, am a member of the Climate Council And I recall very early on making the point that I was excited to work on that project, coming up with our climate plan, because we were coming right out of the pandemic. And there is now demonstrable data showing that for a brief period in time, there was a recorded drop in greenhouse gas emissions owing to the lockdown because people had to stay home. They were not driving. For many people, the offset was that they could telecommute. And as you may be aware, one of the signature issues of my tenure as commissioner has been to do everything I can to aid and abet the deployment of broadband throughout the state, in no small part for that very reason. I have been known in many fora to say that our personal behavior is where we could really have a huge impact as well. I don't know to what degree it needs to be smaller homes or driving less or some mixture of it, but I am convinced that to the extent Vermont is going to be an example to the world about how to, that it can very much be in this matter in our personal conduct and making personal choices that reduce our consumption of energy. With that personal view having been shared, in terms of the larger body of work, yes, I think you would find if you scratch beneath the surface that many of the measures that are under discussion as clean heat measures, take heat pumps, for instance, also have embedded in them efficiency characteristics. So not only is it a decarbonized way of heating, but it is also a manner of heating that requires less energy. And anytime you can use less energy to begin with, you have a massive gain. So it does make its way into the conversation, but Michaela, in my opinion, it's perhaps not in focus the way it ought to be.
Mm. Commissioner, there has been so much politicking going on with this clean heat standard over the last few years, and it's come up a lot on the campaign trail for politicians who are currently running for office ahead of the November election. It's been a point of contention for years now between our governor, Republican Phil Scott, and the Democrat majority legislature. The Public Utility Commission was all appointed by Governor Scott. I'm curious what you would say to folks who are listening who are struggling to figure out the facts here when they are seeing so many partisan debates over this clean heat standard?
Well, I just want to say first, Michaela, that I deplore the politicization of energy policy. One of the reasons I was interested to enter into this 25 years ago was that I had the it turns out, naive idea that there is no Republican electricity and no Democratic electricity. There are light switches, and people have a right to expect that when they flip the switch, there's going to be juice, and it's going to be affordable and have a bunch of other characteristics that we've heaped on. And boy, did I turn out to be wrong. But it's not helpful, in my opinion. You have more than once on the show already pointed to the complexity of the topic. And so to have, in addition to that, perspectives and jockeying and the like introduced is very unfortunate. And I think that at least for many, many years, Vermont had a pretty good way of designing energy policy by having proceedings before the PUC, where there were controlled ways of having the conversation about these things, you know, a record of evidence and the ability to cross-examine people and to test exactly what the assumptions are. Statements that the Jared was making not just a moment ago, for instance, are things that I would very much like to see subjected to cross-examination to tease out where the assumptions and the viewpoints are embedded in statements that we make. But that isn't what we're doing. Instead, what we're doing is basically reverse engineering this policy by taking a mandate to do something and to do it by a certain time and telling the PUC to come up with that program without having first ascertained what we think the ballpark cost of this is, and is it even feasible to do? Based on the study that my agency did, we at least now know that, yeah, it is feasible to do it, but it comes at a considerable cost. And we haven't even really talked yet about who pays those costs. So what I would say to a voter is, if you can tune out the partisan, you know, squabbling, whatever it may be, ask yourself, is this how you think good government works? Do you think that your government is functioning when you get the tax bill that you got this year for your property taxes? You're looking at these increases in your heating costs that are offset by benefits, no question, but still the cost is real. Does this work for you? And then ask the candidates, what are you doing about this? And what has your role been in creating this debate that I'm now struggling to understand, and that I might add, many of their colleagues on YouTube footage online, you can see it, legislators saying, I don't really understand this law, but I'm going to vote for it.
But maybe what could possibly be motivating that is the urgency around this issue, not just the fact that our planet is warming so quickly, but also that we have this Global Warming Solutions Act with goals that we need to hit quite soon. So if not the clean heat standard, if not the situation that we find ourselves in right now, then what? What's the other option?
Well, I would answer your question with another question, which is, why are we doing this to ourselves? Those goals that you talked about that we have to hit, it's entirely self-imposed. It's the legislature that enacted a law that imposed those goals, with not a great understanding, in my opinion, as to what it would take to reach them. That's what's creating this imperative. To be clear, there is a climate crisis, no question. But you heard me say at the outset, I do think we would do better to focus on taking measures to be resilient in the face of climate change, rather than spending our, if you think of it as a credit card with a limited amount of credit on it, what are we going to put on our credit card? Is it the cost of the clean heat standard, or is it maybe going to be the cost of a culvert that I need in order to harden my access to my home?
So sorry, just to be clear, are you saying that you think that the Global Warming Solutions Act should be repealed?
I don't know that it needs to be repealed as much as it needs to be revisited. The dates in there for when we have to hit these targets and so forth, they're clearly causing problems, you know, and the point is, I have never been, I mean, a proponent of this way of governance to begin with. I have to be clear about that. When the legislature was debating the Global Warming Solutions Act, these are concerns that I raised at the time. One of the concerns I was particularly vocal about was the litigation risk of enabling anybody, and I mean anybody, to sue the state because, in that person's opinion, we're not meeting the targets of the Global Warming Solutions Act. I just think it was irresponsible and short-sighted, because the crisis we now have was entirely predictable, which means it's manufactured. And that's a shame, because climate change is hard enough to address.
Well, I want to get to at least one more caller before our time is up. Let's go to Megan in South Burlington. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just, I previously served as a city councilor in South Burlington, and when we were considering an energy standards ordinance on all new residential and commercial properties, one of the most convincing arguments that we heard from someone who works in the field is that we should not be following electrons to determine whether or not electrification is something that is feasible now. It's following dollars. So the more that we invest in new buildings with electrical appliances and heating infrastructure, that is the way, in fact, to reduce the cost of all of these things in the future. And it will serve low-income people who can't necessarily, buy a home but rent a home where there has been electricity, you know, it's been electrified. It will bring down the cost of their utilities. It's a matter of following the dollars, and I find that to be a really strong argument. I encourage everyone to consider it.
Thank you, Megan, for calling in. One more call here before we have to go. Rowan in Walden is on the air. Rowan, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I found an earlier caller's sentiment to be inspiring, in the sense of that it really does come down on personal consumption. I think a lot of people in this state are good at it, buying used clothing in reducing consumption. This is the key to it. It's just personal responsibility. However, the missing element from the conversation continuously is that the countries that do the most polluting are China, they are India, and the entire continent of Africa. This is where industries are not regulated. And to think that it's going to come down to the state of Vermont or even to the United States is a little naive, because the problem is humongous. And over that, the other thing that's underestimated is that the amount of work and the amount of infrastructure associated with flipping us into sustainable energy on the global scale is unimaginably large.
Yeah. Rowan, I'm just going to jump in here because we almost are out of time, and I'd like our guest, June Tierney, the Public Service Commissioner, to respond. June, so much of this is coming, or Commissioner, excuse me, is coming down to this debate between personal, not debate, but the balancing personal responsibility with urging people towards doing the quote-unquote right thing in service of this larger goal of reducing emissions. Do you think that Vermont can lead the way for other states or the world in any of these efforts? Or is that too much to ask a small state?
Well, I think we have to begin by acknowledging our proud history as a small state of indeed leading the world and the country in some energy matters. The work this state did on conceptualizing and regulating and realizing energy efficiency norms is storied and well documented. So, in you know, there are times and moments where Vermont can and does lead, and I certainly think it's commendable, the ethos, the idea that, you know, we're going to do the right thing and show the way. But I have again said several times now on this program, this isn't happening without a larger context. Again, if we have a credit card and you have a limit on your credit card, you know, you have to make priorities or choices about what you're going to charge to that card and how you're going to pay it off. And Vermont's already got some pretty substantial ticket items on its card. Things that come to mind, for instance, are the renewable energy standard and the update that was just passed last year. Our capacity to lead is the question. And on this one, where you're talking about an unproven model, meaning something that's never been done before, and you're not talking about relying on personal behavior, but rather you're talking about using sticks in order to get folks who've never been regulated before to do things you want them to do in order to meet goals for an abstract societal net benefit, I think that's highly problematic and not something Vermont needs to be in the forefront of.
June Tierney. Oh, I'm sorry, June. We're going to have to cut it off here, though there's much more to talk about. We will return to this topic very soon, I hope. June Tierney is the Public Service Commissioner for Vermont. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.